Thank you for listening to this podcast from TRE, Talk Radio Europe, your voice in Spain and around the world. For more information, please visit tre.radio.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Good evening and welcome to tonight's book show. My first guest is Linda Green, an award-winning journalist and the best-selling author of 8 novels. Her latest is The Last Thing She Told Me, described as an emotionally charged suspense novel. It looks at the secrets that women keep hidden from their families. Also with us is Sarah Moore. She's a senior lecturer in the Department of Social and Policy Sciences at the University of Bath and the author of 4 books. She's the co-author of Detecting the Social, Order and Disorder in Post-1970s Detective Fiction. It provides a unique study into the world's favourite reading genre. And finally on tonight's book show is Caroline Montagu, who won her first national poetry competition at 10 years old and from that moment dreamt of being a writer. Her latest novel, An Italian Affair, is set pre and during World War I and is a story of love, betrayal and war. That's all on tonight's book show on Talk Radio Europe.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray. The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now from the UK is Linda Green. She's a best-selling author of 8 novels. She's an award-winning journalist and has written for The Guardian, The Independent on Sunday and The Big Issue. She's with us on the book show to talk about her 9th novel. It's called The Last Thing She Told Me. Welcome to the book show, Linda.
Thanks, Hannah. Lovely to be with you.
Oh, it's great to have you with us. Thank you for joining us. So, is this your 9th book? Is that right?
It is, yeah. I can't quite believe it, to be honest, because it was a long old road getting here. I actually had 102 rejections from agents before I got my first book deal. So it was, quite a torturous process. And so to now find myself on my 9th novel and have it been a top 20 bestseller, which it is at the moment, is a fantastic feeling.
Oh, well done you. Thoroughly deserved. Over 100 rejections. I mean, that must just be really difficult to take. Why did you keep going?
Yeah, no, it's a really good question. And I always say that, you know, anyone sane would have certainly given up at 100, wouldn't they? I mean, anyone that would go past that mark, you have to question it. To be honest, it's a simple reason that it was my lifetime's ambition to be an author. So I figured that's not something that you give up on. And it was really hard. I suppose the thing that out of those 102 rejections, 10 of the agents asked to see the full manuscript and said very nice things about the book. So I suppose I'd had enough encouragement that I was close to think that it was worth persevering with it. But, I hope it serves as a really good lesson to everyone, really, and certainly anyone trying to break into novel writing, that perseverance really is the key. And obviously, looking back now, I'm just very, very glad that I didn't give up at 100, yeah.
Absolutely. So are all the books that you've written a similar genre, would you say?
No, they are slightly different. I think they've just evolved in a way. This one and the previous two, this one is being called an emotional suspense, and the previous two were very much psychological thrillers. And I think really, say, it was just quite a slow process. It wasn't a big shift, but gradually my novel started getting a bit darker. And I just wanted to write about different types of things, really. I suppose, over 15 years I've been writing. So you change, and as you change, I think the things that you're interested in writing about change.
Mm.
And that very much guides things. So While My Eyes Were Closed, which was my seventh book, was the big shift, I suppose, in a way, to a psychological thriller, and that worked out very successfully. And I just carried on really from there. But although they are more psychological thrillers and more recent novels, I'm still very much what I've always been focused on is people. I'm fascinated by people and how they react when bad things happen to them. I think a lot of it is informed by my previous career as a journalist. So again, obviously, 10 years in journalism, and a lot of the time you're interviewing people who are in the news because something bad has happened or something very dramatic. And it was always fascinating to see how different people responded in different ways. And so although it is psychological thrillers that I'm writing now, they're very much written from that personal, from the victim's point of view. Not into police procedures or detective novels or hard crime. So it's really just looking at ordinary people and what happens to them when something quite extraordinary happens.
Yeah, it's interesting how psychological thrillers have become really, really popular over the last sort of 5 years or so. Like,
yeah,
everybody, not everybody, but, a lot of people are really, really reaching for these types of books and these types of stories. What does that say about us, do you think?
Yeah, I think we always are fascinated by but bad things happening to other people, and we are obviously interested in crime. We know that from the news and all sorts of things, and crime novels have always been very, very big anyway. But I think with psychological thrillers, it's that idea of trying to sort of peel back the layers, really, in people, and to try and find out what's underneath, what makes people tick, why people might act in a certain way. And particularly with lots of the psychological thrillers, and mine included, are very much set in a domestic setting. And I think this idea of maybe not realising that there are people very close to us who we can't trust, or that the people that we do trust have actually done something we would be pretty shocked and appalled by. And that is just endlessly fascinating to people. Mm. And that's why they keep reading.
And as you say, how people deal with things, how people get themselves out of tricky situations, or even how they got themselves into them in the first place. I think we all find that really fascinating.
Yeah, and I think very much, we want to look at it. We've got that safety of being the reader and us not being in that situation.
Mm.
But it's to actually look inside somebody else's head and to see the thought processes going on there. And then what we're doing, I think, as we're reading, is saying, well, what would I have done in that circumstance? And would I have trusted that person? And that's what goes on. And, with this book, The Last Thing She Told Me, it's focuses on three generations of women in the same family. And it essentially starts when the grandmother or the great-grandmother of the family dies and tells her granddaughter just seconds before she dies that there are babies at the bottom of the garden.
Gosh.
Which is obviously not something you'd be expecting to be told at that point. And Nicola, the granddaughter, is left with this dilemma once Betty has died as to what does she do with that information. And first of all, does she believe it? And if so, what is she going to do? Is she going to call the police in? What are other family members going to say? Are there secrets that might come out? And, I think a lot of the interest for people is actually playing through with that dilemma of in their families and thinking, well, what would I do? Because there's a natural curiosity, I think, that we want to get to the bottom of a story. We want to solve a mystery. But when it involves our own family and when it's possible that it could uncover things which you really would rather not be uncovered, then I think you're into very, very difficult territory.
Mm, absolutely. And you have had a kind of first-hand experience of your grandmother revealing a family secret, but just before she died, haven't you?
Yeah. I mean, she didn't reveal really the secret, but what she did reveal is that she was essentially going to her grave with a secret, because... she said something which suggested very strongly that she was remembering a loss, remembering some kind of loss that she'd suffered that we didn't know anything about. We don't really know any more than that. I mean, she was 92. Her, you know, no sort of family of her sort of age left, no friends of her age left. There was no clue in any letters that are left or any of her personal things. And obviously, you know, we can look at it and we can have our own theories about what may have happened. And we're aware that certainly, you know, back in those days, even a woman having a miscarriage would have been something which would have been covered up. So, you know, women just didn't talk about things like that. And it may well have been something like that, that, say, people just couldn't talk about at the time. But we will never know. And it just got me thinking about that generation of women where they was just... so much shame related to, you know, from the workings of their own body to what someone else might have done to them, to babies born out of wedlock, and so many secrets. And that's what really made me want to examine this in more detail and to think about how that would have been for that generation, when families were often very complicit in trying to cover up what had happened. Certainly, you know, with babies being born out of whether babies being given away or adopted or raised as somebody else's in the family. And it made me think about the heartache for the young women involved in having to carry that secret all the time and not be able to tell anyone.
Mm. Do you think that there are a lot of women then carrying secrets out there?
I think so. And, you know, when I was researching this novel, I came across an awful lot of stories, actually, you know, that have been in the newspapers over the years of cases where relatives clearing out an elderly lady's home have discovered things from letters that have revealed secrets to sadly, you know, it's been a case where babies' remains were found in a shoebox in the wardrobe and, you know, things like
Gosh.
That. And even talking to friends about the idea, so many of them mentioned older women in their family who had either come out with secrets very late in life and told them about things that had happened. And I just think it's heartbreaking, because the burden of this and having to cope with, you know, particularly those women that cope with the loss of a baby, whether it be given away or whatever happened to it, it's such a heartbreaking thing. And to think that they had to deal with it on their own and never even told very often their own children later on, and to know that for them there would always have been somebody missing at family gatherings, but that they could never have spoken of it. I say, I just think it's heartbreaking. And I just hope that we've made some progress from there, and that, you know, a younger generation won't have to keep those type of secrets.
Mm. And it's an interesting idea, the thought of people kind of on their deathbed telling a secret, and whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, you know, whether it's nice for them to have got it off their chest, or really a bit selfish to kind of put that burden on their family that aren't able to kind of process it properly or discuss it. And
and there's very much two ways of looking at it. And I say, while it's, as you say, while it's completely understandable they want to get it off their chest, that they're then essentially passing it on to the next generation to deal with, and they're not going to be around to fill in the gaps and answer the questions, and it's actually going to leave a lot there. So, I think that's an important point, while it's understandable to want to maybe do that final point, it does then just pass on that burden to somebody else.
Mm.
And certainly, you know, in my novel, the remaining members of the family really struggle with it, and there are very much two schools of thought. You know, Nicola, the granddaughter, wants to get to the bottom of it, wants to uncover the truth, but her mother Irene is adamant that they do not want to put their dirty linen out in public, and that whatever's happened, it's in the past, it needs to stay there and shouldn't be looked into, and that's sort of a real dilemma that runs throughout the book. And again, I just think it's something which a lot of people would stop and think, well, yeah, what would I do in that circumstance? And you know, some secrets maybe are best left in the past, and would people really want to know some of the awful things that have happened? But yeah.
So can you tell us a bit more about the characters in The Last Things She Told? We've got Nicola and Betty.
Yeah, so Betty's the great-grandmother of the family. So she's very much the sort of matriarch figure. She came of age during the Second World War. She served as a land army girl for a while during that time. And then she's lived in the same house in Pettitwell in West Yorkshire, which is just up from Hebden Bridge, since she married. And again, that's something that interested me because, again, my own grandmother had lived in the same house since she married, so she'd had 70 years in the house. And that's something, it doesn't happen nowadays because people can't afford a house in their 20s for a start, and they tend to move around. So I like that sense of having your whole history actually embedded in a house, and that there might be clues within that house to look at. And then Nicola has quite a difficult relationship with her mother, Irene. And Irene had a very strained relationship with her own mother, Betty. So, again, it's clear that something has gone on there. It's clear that all was not well between Betty and her daughter. And Nicola has long wondered why that is. And when these parts of the jigsaw start to come together, it then puts a huge strain on Nicola and her mum, Irene. And again, it's interesting to look at that, you know, when a family is under such huge strain, what breaks and how will relationships be prepared? Nicola's got two children of her own, one who's a teenager who's having a tough time at school. So I think sometimes for women of that generation, that age, you've got teenage children yourself, you've got perhaps an elderly parent to deal with as well, and it can be quite difficult being caught in the middle, and that's very much what happens to Nicola. But I'd never written a novel with that sort of four generations in the same family before, and it was just a really interesting dynamic to explore, really, of how that all works, and to look at, you know, the women over those four generations, and to see how things have changed and improved, but also in some ways perhaps how things are still the same. Because what I realised as I was writing it is actually young women are still shamed for things today. We have social media that, you know, people are now sort of the victims of shamings on social media. So it's things have shifted and changed, but there's still a way that young women are made to feel shame for all sorts of things, and that, in that sense, sadly, not as much perhaps as change as we'd like to think.
No, it's fascinating, isn't it? We like to think that we've moved on and things are a lot better now than they used to be. But as you say, in some ways, if you start examining things, it's just the same, just in a different way with the internet and things.
Yeah, like we've just swapped one set of problems and issues for another set, really. And that was, I say, quite sad to realise, I think, really, just how that is still the case for young women having huge problems in all sorts of areas.
I do think in one way that young women and men, and not necessarily young either, people in general are really, as much as possible, encouraged to talk about things, to talk about their feelings, to talk about their fears and their worries. I mean, saying that, we keep seeing these awful suicides that are happening with young people particularly, which are just dreadful. But it does seem to be that, you know, there is that encouragement, whether it's from media, from schools, from police who go into a lot of schools and do talks on things like this, and also hopefully from parents to be able to say to their kids, you know, do speak out if you're unhappy about things.
Yeah, and it is, as you say, it's so important, and I'm hoping that with you know, each new generation that improves. You know, certainly I think, you know, I've got a 14-year-old son, and we're very close, and I hope that he feels he's able to talk about anything. You know, we do talk about all sorts of things, and particularly, you know, the young male suicide rates are absolutely terrifying.
Yeah.
And I think it's a particular issue for young men, because I think there's still very much this macho culture for teenage boys, and that they have to be a certain way.
Mm.
And although I think perhaps when they're older and maybe into their late 20s and 30s, that they're much more open than previous generations, I think that very difficult time as a adolescent, when you're kind of finding your identity and who you are, and you have that deal with school and college and fitting in. And I think that's where, unfortunately, a lot of boys find that, feel that they don't feel able to speak about any vulnerability, really, because they see it as a sign of weakness. And I think a lot more needs to be done there, particularly to let them know that actually, being able to show vulnerability is a real strength, actually, not a weakness. Yeah,
for sure. Well, it's a great idea for a story. It's called The Last Thing She Told Me. It's by Linda Green, who we've been chatting to. If listeners want to get a copy of the book, it's available on our website, tre.radio, in the bookshop section. Linda, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks very much, Hannah.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
TRE.
Talk Radio Europe. The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now from the UK is Sarah Moore, who's a senior lecturer in the Department of Social and Policy Sciences at the University of Bath and the author of 4 books. She's with us on the book show to talk about her latest book, written alongside Mary Evans and Hazel Johnston. It's called Detecting the Social: Order and Disorder in Post-1970s Detective Fiction. It provides a unique and fascinating study into the world's favourite reading genre. Welcome to the book show, Sarah.
Thank you very much for having me.
Pleasure. Thanks very much for joining us. Interesting idea for a book. Where did the idea and the concept come from?
Yeah, great question. Well, Mary and I had been meeting up for about 7 years prior to the publication of this book. And both of us are professional academic sociologists, but we're also avid fans, readers of detective fiction, and all forms of detective fiction, really. So we've been meeting up over the last 7 years to discuss our favourite detective novels and talk about sort of contemporary politics, the state of our profession. And over time, these various interests and strands of conversation started to coalesce. And particularly, we started to realise that post-1970s detective fiction, especially that of a more critical orientation, possibly had more to say of interest about contemporary politics and the social world than mainstream sociology. And that's where the idea for the book came from, really, I suppose, to kind of, I guess, highlight what we felt to be the sort of really great sociological, political orientation of that post-1970s detective fiction, and kind of steer sociology perhaps more towards the type of issues that body of fiction was treating.
Mm, it's fascinating, isn't it? Because people have always loved the crime detective genre, haven't they?
Yes, absolutely. There's always been a deep fascination with detective fiction since it emerged in, you can trace it all the way back to the 18th century. So the birth of the novel, you really get sort of early detective fiction there, and then it kind of absolutely blossoms in the 19th century. And of course, you've got the queen of crime, Agatha Christie, into the 20th century. So it's got a hugely important, long, rich historical tradition. And you're absolutely right. People, the fascination with detective fiction has been there all along. There are all sorts of theories as to why people love detective fiction. So one sort of strand of argument runs that people read detective fiction for a sense of sort of social catharsis, things being put back together. So one sort of common reading of Agatha Christie's Golden Age fiction is that it provides us with a view of societies that are, or communities that are, totally sundered by crime. And then you get the sort of key figure of Hercule Poirot or Miss Marple come in and do that work of fixing things. So there's a kind of catharsis that comes from that. One of the things that's interesting about post-1970s detective fiction is that it very frequently doesn't leave us with that satisfaction. it doesn't put things back together again. So any sort of avid reader of, for example, Scandinavian noir, Stieg Larsson, Åsa Larsson, these sorts of figures, will have a sense of often endings not being that complete, a sense of problems not necessarily having been sorted out, a sense of underlying corruption and institutional malaise. And we think kind of one of the interesting things about post-1970s detective fiction is how it kind of, if you like, gives voice to those collective fears that are very dominant in our culture at the moment about problems not necessarily being sorted out in a timely, efficient manner. I'm saying this on a very historically important day in a UK context, of course, with Brexit debacle going on. So it seems very timely to be talking in this way today. But there's something very sort of prescient and of the moment, I think, about post-1970s detective fiction sort of conjuring up this world where problems are so stubborn and so resistant to fixing. So that in its own way is a kind of mouthpiece, I think, for our collective fears.
And I guess even though people know that they're reading fiction, I suppose to a point people want to think that it's believable, you know, what's happening in the books could actually happen in today's society.
Oh, yes, I think that's true. And I do think that's a very important aspect of fiction generally. You know, in sociology, we've often sort of cast aside fiction as, you know, simply belonging to the realm of the fantastical, the imagination, the unreal. But the truth is that fiction in general, you know, irrespective of whether it's detective fiction or something else, is conjuring up worlds that we recognise as our own to some degree. So even if you talk to an avid fan of science fiction, for example, which sort of very classically, in inverted commas, unreal, they'll often say that part of their joy of reading that is that it kind of engages their imaginative faculties on very real, pressing, political, social issues of the day. And I think detective fiction, absolutely, there's a sort of sense of this is recognisably our social world. We can engage with these moral mazes and these questions of crime and deviance because we sort of recognise them as possible, you know, in our sort of contemporary context.
So when you looked at how things have changed since the 1970s, is there a kind of a clear pattern of how people write crime and detective novels and how it's changed over the years?
Yeah, there is. I mean, this is without wishing to put down too hard a line in the soil. But yes, you know, part of our purpose with the book is to sort of signal what we see as quite a significant wide-scale change. So the book looks at detective fiction across Europe. It's not constrained to, you know, for example, Scandinavian noir or anything like that. And it's trying to suggest that across those different bodies of national fiction, you can see the emergence of what you might call a collective genre of detective fiction in that post-1970s era. And certainly, I mean, I've already mentioned this, but one of the key things is the different emphasis on institutional corruption, on stubborn problems that won't go away. And that post-1970s detective fiction, not all of it, but an important strand of it, is interested in laying bare and unravelling sort of very messy problems. And if you think about the sort of detective fiction of the 1920s and 1930s, something like an Agatha Christie novel, they're very kind of clearly whodunits. You know, that's how we would sort of describe, I think, those sorts of novels. And today, sort of post-1970s detective fiction is less interested in that sort of very specific question of who did this bad thing, as it is a sort of laying bare the sort of conditions and the messy relationships that gave rise to really toxic relationships and situations. And again, I think, you know, any avid reader of Stieg Larsson or Tana French or Pierre Lemaitre, any of these sort of really important post-1970s detective fiction writers will be familiar with that sort of idea of very thorny, messy problems that can't be easily solved by rooting out a bad apple.
Mm. And what about female detectives?
Oh, yes. Wow, this is a tricky question. So we certainly see, I mean, detective fiction across the 20th century has sort of had this liberal side to it, if you like, in terms of gender. So think about Miss Marple in Agatha Christie's fiction. You know, we've had female detectives as quite a key a figure in detective fiction over the last 150 years or so. But there is something very interesting in post-1970s detective fiction about, you can see the sudden proliferation of female detectives, and they're fascinating characters. I mean, without wanting to suggest that that whole body of literature is entirely liberal in its approach to gender, you do get some interesting ideas there, I think, about how female detectives can potentially spot problems of intimate domestic violence in a way that a male detective doesn't or can't. And that's a sort of prevailing concern in post-1970s detective fiction, the way in which some of the sort of worse abuses of power come from within the family or within intimate relationships. So I think, for example, a really great writer for capturing all of this is Asa Larson. He's much less read than her fellow countryman Stieg Larsson, but Asa Larson does a great job of bringing to life female detectives, and they seem to have this sort of greater intuition, if you like, or greater ability to see the problems that go on behind closed doors.
Because female detectives haven't necessarily kind of evolved in a way that maybe we as women would have liked. You know, often they're represented as single and kind of unlovable women who are dedicated to their job and therefore don't have time for a husband and children.
Yeah, there is that element. And I suppose to pick up on that point I made before about, you know, we wouldn't want to wish to suggest that all post-1970s detective fiction is terribly liberal in its gender politics, and that's certainly true. And I would say one of the other things that's worth pointing out here is the fact that, you know, for female detectives, what you often get is quite an unhealthy clash between family life and working life. And that sort of tension, you know, sort of managing the demands of a family and children and being so dedicated to a job that one's sort of hunting down a criminal 24/7, which is obviously a key attribute of the successful detective. But you do get this sort of sense of a commitment to home life being a particular problem for female detectives. So there is something very interesting about a sort of a potentially quite conservative element, if you like, to that portrayal.
Mm. Well, it's a great idea for a book. It's lovely to chat with you about it. Sarah Moore, thank you very much for joining us. I just want
to
ask you briefly about, I mentioned in the introduction that you've written other books before. Is this very different to the kind of books you've written?
Totally different. Totally different. So I'm one of those magpie academics who sort of writes about all sorts of things. So the book I wrote before this was about legal aid and the retrenchment of legal aid in the UK context.
Wow.
Yes, I know. So, and my very first book was about awareness ribbons, like the breast cancer awareness ribbon, and so totally different stuff. But, you know, this is, you know, I see it as a very privileged job to have, to be able to write about things that I think are of general interest and value.
Yeah. Have you enjoyed this one particularly then?
I've loved this one. This by far has been my favourite book to write. Working with Mary and Hazel was a total delight. And the fact that this was quite a slow-burning enterprise as well, having sort of thought about it over the course of 7 years, you know, means that it's kind of benefited, I think, from that more slow burning type of intellectual work and reading, of course.
Yeah.
So it was a total pleasure to write this.
Oh, that's good to hear. Well, if people want to get a copy of the book, it's available to buy in the bookshop section on our website, tre.radio. It's called Detecting the Social, and it's by Mary Evans, Hazel Johnston and Sarah Moore, who we've been chatting to. Sarah, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray. The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now from the UK is Caroline Montagu. She won her first national poetry competition at 10 years old and from that moment dreamed of being a writer. She's with us on the book show to talk about her novel, An Italian Affair. It's a sweeping story of love, betrayal and war. Welcome to the book show, Caroline.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
It's lovely to have you with us. And a beautiful front cover, I have to comment on, first of all. It's really nicely done.
isn't it? It's wonderful. I had nothing to do with it at all, entirely due to Orion. And when it arrived, I thought, oh, and the glittery bits. I just love the glittery bits around the edge.
Yes.
It's so pretty. So, no, I was completely delighted with it.
So where did the kind of inspiration for this story come from? I know I mentioned in the introduction that there's a story of love, betrayal and war. It is set partly in Britain, partly in Italy, and sort of pre-World War One and the start of World War One.
Yeah, well, I bought a house in Italy 12 years ago, and it's got lovely meadows and woods, and I very quickly got to know my neighbours, and Giovanni, wonderful Italian gentleman, very elderly gentleman who has recently sadly died, told me that during the war in, from 1943, he was hiding in the woods around my house. Because they all were, because, you know, they didn't want to get sent to either the Russian front, the munitions factories in Germany. And so they were all hiding around my house. And I just thought it was extraordinary. And so I began to dig a little. And the more you dig, the more stories you get. And I was absolutely hooked. And then I decided, actually, I'm going to have a family divided by war. So it starts off in England. And then half of the family, or the mother and the daughter, move to Italy. And the son becomes a Spitfire pilot in England. So it was a wonderful sort of premise for a story, and then I had to write it.
Yes. Isn't that fascinating to find that out, just literally around your house and wood area?
It's extraordinary. But this part of Italy, it's on the Tuscan-Umbria borders. There are sort of lots of hidden pastures and terrain that the Italians would know, and the Italian country sort of people would know, and the farmers, but the actual enemy wouldn't. And so it was the perfect place to hide.
Mm, fabulous. So how did you go about constructing it into a story? I know that's not the story, but making the whole thing into a book.
Well, I have a huge imagination. And I started in London. I decided that actually I wanted my hero, Robert, to be a Spitfire pilot. So I enlisted the help of two wonderful elderly gentlemen, both who sadly died. And one had been an engineer in bomber command, and the other had been a fighter pilot, but just after the war, and he did a lot of training and testing on aircraft and everything. And between the two of them, I'd have seminars there every fortnight, and I would do a piece of work, and then they'd check it literally, put a line through it and say, Caroline, go away, here's another book to read. I mean, I read so much. And you know, when your friends are all reading these wonderful novels, and I'm reading sort of Jeff Whelan, First Light, which was incredible, but you know, I was not reading the same kind of books as everyone else. I constructed my story around him being a fighter pilot in England and fighting to save, you know, in the Battle of Britain, fighting to save England, and his mother and sister in Italy on the other side. And that, from there, you know, once you've actually started, the book takes over, and of course you learn of all their adventures and his adventures fighting his life in the skies above England.
Yes. I think it's wonderful that your research consisted of reading actual books, because so often people now, their research is just done on Google, which is fine. You know, the internet is fantastic for getting information. But lovely. I feel you sort of went the extra mile with your research, which is nice.
Well, you see, if you think about it, my wonderful Jerry Tyack and Ian Panton, who were in their 80s and 90s, the internet was not an issue. They didn't have the internet. And so they would just literally, Jerry owned something called Wellington Aviation, a little museum in Moreton in Marsh, and it was filled with books. And so literally every week I'd go home with an armful and he'd say, read them. And honestly, I tell you what, I have... And when he never asked for them back, and actually I did try to give them back, and he said, no, keep them. And I've still got these marvelous books all about the war and about the resistance fighters, about the French resistance fighters, the Italian partisans, about the Guinea Pig Club. He sent me one. I did a whole chapter on the Guinea Pig Club, actually, which was where... injured servicemen were sent to be operated on by Mackindo, who's this pioneering surgeon. In fact, the book was getting so big that it was sadly edited. But, you know, I learned so much, and it was absolutely incredible.
Isn't it fascinating? I think it would be so easy for people to think, oh, yes, you know a lot about World War II, or know it all, even, you know, having read books, seen films, documentaries, that kind of thing. So it's just amazing to think that there's so much more information that we don't yet know.
Oh, my goodness. Honestly, these men taught me more than I could have dreamed possible. And I am so privileged to have known them. And when they died, both of them, naturally, because they were very old, but I was completely devastated. Because they had just given me such a gift and been such friends.
Yeah.
Always over tea and sandwiches.
Oh, fabulous.
So what a joy.
Yeah, again, to be able to have got the first-hand accounts from these men is fabulous,
yeah.
Isn't it?
Yeah. And he had Wellington Aviation. He had, bits of bomber and bits of Spitfire all in cases. And in fact, for my birthday, he gave me a ring stand made of a cylinder from a Spitfire.
Wow.
And he put the name, I know, isn't that wonderful? And you know what? He made it a ring stand on a piece of Perspex and put the name of the hero on my hero, Robert Marston, is on the bottom, Battle of Britain. Isn't that wonderful?
Oh, how fabulous. Special men they were.
Isn't that? And so every time I put a ring on my ring stand, I think of Jerry and I think of the, the Spitfire that it came from.
Yes. So. Oh, fantastic. So tell us a bit more about some of the characters in the book.
So we have Robert, a Spitfire pilot, who's a sensitive young man and who turns into this extremely, extraordinarily brave man who actually survives the Battle of Britain. I don't want to give too much away, but he then becomes a member of the SOE, which was dropped behind enemy lines to teach the Italians how to form resistance groups and the partisans. So he becomes a superb SOE member and trains the partisans in Italy. And then we have Douglas, who is his mentor in England and who is actually a neurosurgeon, or in fact, professor of neurosurgery. And we learn a lot about him, and I'm not going to say too much more about him because I don't want to give too much away.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have Alessandra, who is Robert's half-Italian mother, who has inherited this beautiful house in Italy. Her husband, Anthony Marston, at the very beginning of the book, is I can say this because he's very, it happens in the first, in the prologue, the husband is killed, so their whole life is unbalanced. And for 2 years they live in London, and they have to leave their house, and she goes out to work and everything, and then she inherits this house in Italy. But does she take it? When there was the possibility, not a probability at this stage, we're talking about 1937, the possibility that we were going to be at war again, and possibility, because of Mussolini and the pact with Germany and Japan looming, was it a good idea to take a house in Italy at this time? No.
Mm.
But her prospects in England were not not particularly good. And so she decides in the end, against, huge worry, concern, anxiety, to take the house in Italy and to leave Robert, her son, who's 15 at the time, because he doesn't want to go. He's happy at school. Leave him in England. And Diana and Alessandra go and live in England, in Italy, at a time of political turmoil, really. Fascists, Mussolini. So there was so much to learn, fascinating stuff.
Mm. It must have been difficult for her to leave her son behind, though.
Hugely difficult, and an extraordinary decision. But in the end, it was Robert, so that, to make it clear that Alessandra was so torn, it was Robert who made her go and said, look, in England, you've got very little. Over there, you've got a chance of a life, and it's in the countryside. You'll be away from the danger, hopefully. And he makes her promise that if danger comes to the part, she'll leave. A huge decision, and consequently, it causes lots of situations, which, makes it much more an interesting family dynamic to write about.
Yes.
So I hope I've done it justice.
I'm sure. You must have enjoyed the whole process.
Oh, I loved it. I find when I'm writing, and I'm sure so many other writers find this, that actually the story takes over, and you think actually you're literally being taken over by this weird force, because I'd write and I think, where did that come from? And it is bizarre, but when you're so into a story, the characters start to write it themselves, I find.
Yeah.
Maybe I'm a little bit mad.
Not at all. That's great that happens. And
it does.
I have to ask you about the house that you live in, if you don't mind, because T.S. Eliot was inspired by your home to write the first of his four quartets. That's quite a claim to fame, isn't it?
Isn't it incredible? And that, I think, probably kick-started my writing career, because I've written, as you very kindly said, from the age of four. I started writing poetry, and I've written all my life, and I've written children's stories, but I'd never had the actual courage to take anything to a publisher until I came to Burnt Norton 20 years ago with my husband. The house has been in his family for 250 years, but actually 270 now, I think. And we came to live here with all our children. And it is the most extraordinary place. And of course, there are the pools where Eliot came and sat by the pools and was inspired to write the first of the four quartets. And somehow it inspired me, and the fact that he'd written this wonderful, extraordinary poem about time past and time present and the children hidden in the shrubbery, and it just inspired me, because I sort of managed, you know, with my huge imagination, I thought it was my children in the shrubbery. And it totally inspired me. But it is the most incredible house to live, and I'm very privileged, yeah.
Lovely. Well, if people want to get a copy of An Italian Affair, it's out now and available to buy on our website in the TRE bookshop section. And it's by Caroline Montagu, who we've been talking to today. Caroline, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, it has been the greatest pleasure. Thank you for having me.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
You've been listening to a TRE production. If you've enjoyed this program, there'll be another episode waiting for you next week, right here on this platform, where you can also access our extensive back catalog of shows and interviews. For more information on our live programming, social media channels, and apps, and how to contact Talk Radio Europe, please visit tre.radio.